Hi, I'm comic book writer and occultist Alan Moore, and I like to listen to Resonance FM.
It's true, he does. You're listening to Panel Borders, which is an extract from Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comic books. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is the second half of my 2008 interview with Alan Moore, looking at his graphic novels Lost Girls and The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, The Black Dossier, and also discussing the artwork created for the former by Melinda Gebbie.
When it came to the various artists that she was going to homage in the book, did you have a short list that she picked and chose from, or did you definitely know which ones you wanted?
Well, we went through, and there were people that we originally planned to use. I think for the final one, which we decided to go with Anonymous, because we thought, well, yeah, he deserves a mention. He, she deserves a mention. But we were originally going to use Feliciane Rops and illustrating poetry by Baudelaire.
Okay.
And Melinda did a couple of great illustrations in the Rops style.
Mm.
But they were... If you're going to do Rops, it has to be kind of rabidly anti-clerical.
Mm.
Which, yeah, I'm fairly rabidly anti-clerical, but... That wasn't what Lost Girls was about.
Mm.
And at that particular juncture of the narrative in the last book,
mm.
I thought it would have been a distraction.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have served any purpose.
Mm.
And Baudelaire's writing, I don't even know whether I could have written like Baudelaire. You know, I mean, Oscar Wilde was difficult enough. You know, that was a nightmare. He was such a smart bastard that every sentence is a beautifully turned epigram.
Yeah.
You know, even if he's just going down the shops for 20 Rothmans to replace the ones that have been stolen from the fingers of his statue, you know.
I mean, it's interesting as well, because both with Lost Girls and The Black Dossier, you're pastiching various other writers' styles as well as asking the artist to do that on your behalf. I mean, how much of a challenge was that, other than, you know, Oscar?
Well, I like doing it. I like showing off. I mean, and a lot of the bits in Lost Girls, they vary.
Mm.
They vary in how successful I think I was.
Okay.
You know, I think I was okay with the Oscar Wilde. The Guillaume Apollinaire, it doesn't actually read much like Guillaume Apollinaire.
Mm.
You know, Pierre-Louis, I toned it down because Pierre-Louis is a filthy scatological whoremonger. You know, sort of, he's dead, it's all right, we can say that.
Fine.
You know, but I've got a great deal of admiration for him.
Mm.
But I toned it down a little.
Okay.
You know, whereas in The Black Dossier, I mean, that Jack Kerouac pastiche, how cool is that? You know, and yeah, I mean, obviously it's showing off doing Woodhouse and Shakespeare and Jack Kerouac.
I particularly like the Woodhouse, I must say.
We had a lot of fun doing that. That was great. You know, it's sort of... and you only have to read a little bit of these authors and it all comes back to you.
Yeah.
You can talk in that voice, you know. But I think that the Kerouac piece in particular was one of the best things that I've ever written, just in terms of its flow and its kind of bebop, kind of stylings, you know.
I mean, when it came to Kevin doing the pastiches in The Black Dossier, I mean, how much of a challenge was it for him to?
Well, I thought that Kevin had probably showed himself.
I mean, it's astonishing.
Yeah. Absolutely, as great an advantage as I had, or if not more. I mean, like, he's doing Gilray, he's sort of doing these kind of pastiches of the great 1950s posh British boys comics with the painted, you know, sort of Wrath of the Gods or, you know, Heros the Spartan or things like that, which he'd got all into The Life of Orlando. The 3D work at the end, which must have been a nightmare for him to actually draw. I know that my script pages for that, I mean, it was something like 10 pages of type to describe a 2-page spread, which is like 5 pages of type for every page of the comic, you know. And, I mean, and there's still an awful lot of things that Kevin put into the background that I haven't even noticed yet. I had somebody asking me the other day, they were saying that they'd read The Black Dossier, they really liked the reference to Brazil. And I kind of said,
I didn't write one.
what reference to Brazil was that? And it turns out that there's a little strangely designed snub-nosed car on the motorway. And sort of this is the car that Jonathan Pryce uses to flee when he's on the run from the authorities. But and a dozen other things like that that I haven't even noticed yet. I've spotted most of the things that he's worked in, but no, I mean, it was fantastic. I mean, it really does show the incredible range that Kevin's got. And I mean, I love the Fanny Hill illustrations, you know. That was kind of like Kevin's take on Bayros, you know, sort of. But yeah, I mean, we had a lot of fun, both of us, on the Black Dossier. It gave us a chance to really show off what the concept of the league could do and what we could do with it as creators. I mean, a bit unfortunate, some of the trials and tribulations that have been visited upon the Black Dossier. But you know,
well, I mean, I wouldn't want to suggest that maybe you did some of those on purpose just to make it difficult for DC.
No, we didn't do anything. Right, it was sort of, I mean, like DC's legal department had cleared it all last summer. They said it was all fine.
That's how inept they are, obviously.
Yeah, well, I mean, they'd already kind of, they had done things to just irritate us because they don't like us since we're going to be published by somebody else who will treat us more fairly. But they'd cleared it for publication last summer, and then it turns out that a sweaty third-rate Hollywood movie producer of our former acquaintance, who both of us had previously told never to call us again, because we thought that he was human sewage, basically, you know, and we'd expressed that opinion and told him never to contact us. Apparently in a fit of pique or spite, because Hollywood producers really aren't used to being spoken to like that, you know. It was him, apparently, who had gone in and threatened DC, who when it comes to dealing with sweaty third-rate Hollywood movie producers, they are particularly spineless.
Well, I mean, considering that DC is part of the conglomerate time
of the Warner thing, you know, I mean, yeah, so they'd rolled over, and that's what led to all of the messing about and the fact that the Black Dossier is not officially available in England or Canada.
Yeah, and you can't buy it upstairs for $12.99.
You certainly can't.
No, that would be wrong.
That would be wrong.
It seems quite obvious to say, since we're discussing Lost Girls, that sex is an important theme in your work. I mean, particularly more so than other comic book writers, which seems absurd since there's so much sexual tension in books about people in spandex beating each other up, but, you know, ignoring that. a question that I asked you a year ago that I managed to fluff, I'll try and word it a bit better this time, was, for example, in Swamp Thing, when the character goes into space, you use the different alien planets as metaphors for different versions of sexual experience. Like the blue planet is a very masturbatory experience. His encounter with the kind of techno-organic asteroid is all about obsessional relationships.
Yes.
His landing on Ra'an, I mean, he literally impregnates the entire planet.
Yeah, I mean, like that. I hadn't actually the final one of those. I hadn't actually meant that one to be particularly sexual. Although, yes, I suppose I can see it now. You don't often realise these things at the time. I mean, the other two, yeah. I mean, like, they were intended to be sexual. And there was an earlier episode of Swamp Thing, the Swamp Sex issue, the number 34 or something like that. Well, I mean, I was very pleased with it myself because we were kind of, we were seeing if how far we could push the Swamp Thing as a concept, whether we could take it into these other areas. And I thought, well, if I can do a sex story about a kind of a creature that's made of vegetation in this kind of fabulous psychedelic manner, then, you know, I should be able to handle sort of sex scenes in my other work. I mean, different sorts of sex scenes, but I would always try to work sex scenes in there because if you're trying to create believable characters, then all believable characters have some sort of sexual component, even if it's not expressed.
Well, exactly.
So I would always make it as much of an element of my characters as, you know, their personalities, the way they acted with other people, or their superpowers. You know, in fact, probably the sexuality might be more important than the superpowers.
Yeah.
You know, so this was something that I kind of carried on throughout my early career in Marvel Man, in various other works. And it started to occur to me that it might be possible to do an extended narrative about sex that didn't involve a bog monster or a superpowered being from another world.
Yeah.
You know, radical, I know, but and that was kind of, you know, could I just talk about sex?
Mm.
And also, could I talk about it without resorting to making it a joke or a horror story?
Mm.
Because I'd noticed that when sex is dealt with in comics, it's generally made to be an element of a horror story or perhaps a humour story. Mm. Nothing wrong with those things, but...
Well, ironically, the first time you brought out a comic that was particularly controversial was that issue of Swamp Thing where Abby is suffering from post-traumatic stress and sort of wanders around naked, scrubbing herself with, you know, various kitchen implements.
Yeah, they only gave me 2 days to write that one, and that was the one where we lost the comics code sticker, so that turned out quite nicely. You know, it's... yeah, you know, I mean, like, it just seemed that horror... It's easy to do a sexual horror story because people have got strange, unexpressed feelings about sex. If you can connect up some horror motif like vampirism or something like that to it, you can make people feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like the route taken by the Alien movies where everything looks like some sort of enormous cock of some variety or other, you know. So that's fairly easy. And, of course, with humour.
Mm.
I mean, sort of some brilliant pieces by Robert Crumb, where, yes, they're full of sex, but it is presented in a humorous way. Which, actually, generally, when I think of sex, I'm not generally either laughing or screaming.
Mm.
You know, it's not, I don't think, most people's experience. It's just about itself.
Yeah.
So what we wanted to do was a book where we didn't duck behind any other genres, where we just came at pornography full on and sort of treated that as a genre in itself and tried to work out what its conventions were and then try to apply them in a different way. Pretty much the same as I'd done with superheroes and Watchmen. But here we were thinking, oh yeah, well, a lot of the stories, they're set in an isolated chateau or something like that, cut off from the rest of the world. That's good. We'll have this hotel, you know, and there's lots of stories where people will tell their sexual histories while in the middle of some sort of sexual belt or other. That's a good little convention. We can use that.
Yeah.
And so on. We just sort of built it up from there, really.
Mm. But, I mean, you know, since we seem to live in an entertainment society where horror and violence is far more acceptable than sex, I think it's indicative, just looking at your comics, for example, in Marvel Man or Miracle Man, whatever it was called at the time, the end of your trilogy is like absolutely horrific scenes of hell on earth, but the issue that caused controversy was when Liz Moran gives birth. You know?
Yeah, what's that all about? I mean, I can remember that when I was originally talking about the birth issue of Miracle Man, and that was... the editor at the time, that was at Warrior, and the editor at the time said, so what sort of angle would you be thinking of taking upon this childbirth? And I said, from the front, you know.
Anatomically correct.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, it's the way we all came into the world.
Mm.
You know, surely it's not wrong to draw it in a sort of a cheap sort of $1.50 American superhero comic book. That's my attitude anyway.
I'm curious about the relationship between the characters in Lost Girls in the fictional universe and the versions of their stories that we know in this world, because in the Black Dossier you have books existing in the world of League Extraordinary Gentlemen which are tales of their exploits written by famous authors. So when it comes to the books, or rather the play Peter Pan, the books Alice in Wonderland and The Wizard of Oz, I mean, off screen, do Alice, Dorothy and Wendy meet Jay and Barry?
No, they're in a different... The two works, even though The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen actually conceptually grew out of Lost Girls, because we'd had such fun doing three fictional characters in a sex context that I thought maybe this could work as an adventure book.
Yeah.
You know, but they're very separate.
Mm.
I think Lost Girls kind of takes place in our world.
Yeah.
The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen takes place in a world of fiction. No, I mean, like, I think that they happen in very different universes. The, like I say, the world in which Lost Girls happens is pretty much our world.
Yeah.
With a couple of little flourishes, you know, around the edges. It could have happened in our world.
Okay.
You know. The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen all takes place in this kind of world that is like a grand unified field theorem of fiction, where all the stories actually happened. Some of them, the more famous ones, their authors are known as well. In the, yeah. But Shakespeare is regarded as the great biographer, and so is Cervantes.
Mm.
You know, and so is Conan Doyle, presumably.
Yeah.
You know, so no, I don't think that our Lost Girls do hang out with Jay and Barry in some kind. It's a nice idea, I suppose. Mm. They'd probably frighten him.
Yes. but I mean, at the same time, thinking of your ideas and idea space and how perhaps events that happen in this sort of shared universe leak into our world, if only as inspiration for writers, perhaps.
Sure.
You have these full page illustrations, these brilliant full page illustrations by Melinda, where you show iconic scenes from the three novels but sexualized. So it's kind of like the halfway house between the two.
Yeah, it was sort of, I mean,
they're fantasies, obviously.
Yeah, we kind of, we got those planned at the very beginning, these big silent pages that would just be an image, that would be a key image from one of those books, but sexualised. Some of my favourite images in the books, I mean, the two most telling ones, I think, are in the last book, where you've got the two pages which me and Melinda referred to as the pussy gator and the jabbercock, where we've got these. I mean, it's they were horrific pages in some way, and the first reaction of everybody to them is to laugh, because they're so absurd, and in some ways they sum up each gender's fears about the other one. This sort of vagina dentata. In the Wendy chapter, which it was a great visual metaphor, the way that this paedophile figure, this Captain Hook figure, is kind of swallowed by adult womanhood, the thing that he fears.
Yeah.
And I found out recently that apparently some people who are actually working with paedophiles say that, well, actually, it's a misnomer. They're not lovers of children. They're frightened of adults and adult relationships.
Right, okay.
It's more, they're more reacting, it's more a thing of control.
Mm.
They feel that they're out of control of their lives, that larger forces control them. The only place that they feel safe to put their sexuality is in children, because children are helpless.
Mm.
You know, probably the same thing would apply with any other kind of helpless individual. It's sort of, so I think that a lot of the things that just we intuited in the course of Lost Girls, I think that they could have some basis in psychological reality. We even heard about a couple of young women who had themselves been sexually abused when they were children.
Right.
And they were having Lost Girls explained to them by a friend. And she'd said, well, basically, it's these women and the things that have happened to them in their younger days, the abuse or whatever, they have turned it into a kind of compensatory fantasy. They've distanced themselves from it by making it into a fantasy. And both of these women who'd actually suffered sexual abuse said, well, that's exactly what I did.
Right.
So I guess that must be a fairly common thing.
Mm.
And, like I say, it seems that our instincts were right on that one.
Cool. So that I can work our videographer's favourite work of yours into the script. The you that wrote Viva Vendetta was obviously an angrier young man than the you who wrote Lost Girls, because that presents a possible future as a dystopia, but one where there's hope at the end, while with Lost Girls presents the past as a utopia, but then ends with a bit of despair as, you know, the real world encroaches on it.
And it also does end with a poppy in the last panel, which kind of symbolises, I mean, life, it's been used to symbolise the imagination, the opium that Alice indulges in, the poppy field where Wendy, where Dorothy has her encounter with the farm labourers, and in the original Wizard of Oz, the poppy field where Dorothy is lulled to sleep. So using that as a symbol in the last panel, it kind of suggests that, yes, this is pretty awful. But even in the midst of all this, even in the midst of all this carnage, the imagination, it does flourish, it does grow.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd say that if anything, I am angrier now than when I wrote V for Vendetta, and I'm smarter. It's sort of, I don't think that it is, I don't think that it's at the time, back when I did V for Vendetta, there was a point in Shouting Fire. You know, now civilization is actually burning down around our ears. And it's probably not the most helpful thing to shout. I think that what you need to try and supply to people is, as I tried to do in V for Vendetta as well, to a certain extent, it's point out the exits. Try and point out the fire exits to your readership. Try and give them some way out. Never abandon your readers in the middle of a hellish train of thought. You know, so Melinda said that when she first read Watchmen, before she met me, and she thought, this is really gripping. I hope this is not going to end really, really horribly, because... And it didn't. It sort of... It wasn't the bleak, you know, complete end of the world that she'd been expecting. It was different. And your readers have to be able to trust you, that you're not going to do something to them that is absolutely unbearable. Even though I suspect that at various points during From Hell, probably most of my readership had cause for doubt. You know.
In terms of Lost Girls reaching a wider audience, I mean, obviously it's a fairly, you know, select group who will buy it, because A, it is pornography and you're not embarrassed about saying it is, otherwise, you know, other people would package it as erotica, but you defuse that argument.
Absolutely.
I've not seen the episode of The Simpsons that you're in, but I saw a screen grab from it, and you're sitting in front of a poster for Lost Girls.
Lost Girls.
So I was drawn in an advert.
Running style. How cool is that? Exactly. Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, we had a lot of fun doing that, and yeah, it was pretty cool to have that poster up on the wall, which is actually an image from Lost Girls, but redrawn.
Okay.
And they've done a really great job of it, you know. I mean, all the characters are yellow and I've got three fingers, but other than that, you know, it's sort of, that's got to be somebody's turn on, doesn't it? You know. But, yeah, you know, I think that the important thing about The Simpsons is that now everybody knows, firstly, just what a incredible rippling physique I have under these clothes, and secondly, that I can fly. You know, these
as
are aspects.
Suspect.
Yeah, well, these are aspects of my being that I've never sort of emphasised them too much, you know, but it's things that people should know. You know.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, my pleasure.
If you'd like to hear the interview I conducted last year with Alan, which includes more on The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and Swamp Thing, as well as discussions of other animation, his love of magic, and info on his next project, The Bumper Book of Magic, for boys, you can do so at www.panelborders.com if you click on the link marked Alan Moore. I'd like to thank Gosh Comics in Great Russell Street in London for allowing us to record the interview in their premises, and if you're listening to this podcast before midnight on the 20th of February 2008, you can win a copy of Lost Girls that they've kindly supplied us if you send me an email with the Christian names of the three main characters to backprojection@hotmail.com. That's backprojection. @hotmail.com. So as to provide a similar bookend to Alan's plug of Resonance, which opened this podcast, I'll let the great man help promote the comic store run by Ollie Smith, who did a fine job of videoing this podcast, which you should be able to find in the same place you downloaded this, unless it's still the first week after broadcast and I haven't uploaded it yet.
Good day, my name's Alan Moore, and whenever I'm in London, I like to chill with Ollie and his homeboys down at the London Underground Comic Store in Camden.
You can find more info about the stall at www.londonundergroundcomics.com. Should you be listening to this podcast before the end of spring 2008, you might like to vote in this year's Eagle Awards for Ollie's videos in the comics-related film and video category, and for me, Alex Fitch, in the Contributors to Comics Awareness Roll of Honour, for which I would be very grateful. You can find around 60 comics interviews I've recorded for Resonance FM thus far at www.panelborders.com, including ones with Alan's daughter Leah and her writing partner John Repian, as well as with the likes of Neil Gaiman, Mike Mignola, Pat Mills, Peter David, Brian Talbot, and Paul Cornell. Thanks for listening.